outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gen.
Hey, before we get to the podcast this morning, I want to make an announcement that we keep forgetting to talk about when we're doing the podcast. Kyle and I wanted to remind those of you in your 20s and 30s that we're getting a bunch of us together in Colorado the first week of December. That's Westcliff, Colorado, December 3 through 5. We're gathering just to see what God's doing in that age group and to explore how God's inviting a new generation into the fullness of his life. If you're interested, you can get more information on a link at the bottom of the podcast notes, or you can email Kyle or me. Now, let's get to it. So, Kyle, if, in fact, God was going to give us over to the dragon of China in 5 years as a day of reckoning for the United States, would you want to know it now, or would you want to know it then?
The dragon of China in 5 years. I think that that would be a distraction to me. I think that
you think,
well, to be bluntly honest, like, I mean, that's just another way of moving away from living life in the day to day of waking up and asking God, how do you want me to engage with the world today? And I guarantee you my futuristic, strategic, naturally bent self would try to manage and arrange and make things happen without following the nudge and the prompting of the Holy Spirit. So if something like that was coming and the Holy Spirit wanted to prepare me for something like that or provide some wisdom on how to navigate something like that, he could show me. But to preemptively prep for it and to try to take it in my own strength, I would make a train wreck out of it. I just think I would. What about you? That's a crazy question. All right, tell me about that.
Tell you about the question?
Like, what would you do, first of all? And then second of all, where did that even come from?
Well, I thought about it because a friend had a dream. And in the dream, it's a strange dream. And he wasn't claiming it to be, quote unquote, from God. But he sees Jesus sitting at this desk. And Jesus has a paper in front of him. And he comes into this room. And Jesus is really, really sad. And so Jesus, he says, what's wrong? What's the matter? And turns the paper towards him, and in the paper, it's a request for emancipation, and it's from the United States against his father. And so my friend is just like, "What? What is going on here?" And then he has a paper of a divorce between quote unquote religious Christian quote unquote people in America wanting a divorce from following Jesus. They want to follow their own. So there's that, and then there's finally some paper in Chinese, and it was the whole sense of the dream was, I'm finally at the point where if I don't give my people over to the dragon, they'll no longer see me. Mm. The reason that dream hits me so weird, and it did, is because I was reading Ezekiel at the time. I've since finished, but that's exactly what Ezekiel's doing. Ezekiel's telling Israel, look, this is what's coming, and you're about to be destroyed, which is a crazy thing, because when Jonah goes and tells Nineveh that it's about to happen to them, they repent like crazy. They're not even offered repentance. God keeps telling Israel, man, turn back to me, turn back to me. And Israel just does not turn. They just don't believe it. They don't believe. It's easier to disbelieve Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Isaiah. We know them as big time dudes now. They were the prophets. But in their time, they had better prophets telling them what they wanted to hear. So in Ezekiel's, basically telling him, this is what's coming. And the reason I'm telling you is so that when it happens, you won't think God has abandoned you. I mean, I'm giving you over because that's the only way you're going to find me now. You're so fully lost in your delusion that until that crash lands somewhere, and it's going to crash land in Babylon, and even tells them, the king, don't resist them. If you resist them, it will go worse for you. And in the face of this dream and reading Ezekiel, I got thinking, man, put all that in contemporary fashion today. What if somebody was telling us that? A, would we believe them? B, wouldn't we fight if America was attacked by the Chinese? Wouldn't it be the Christian thing to do to go sign up for the military if you're young enough and go, you know, fight off the and do whatever you can do to fight off these communist Chinese that want to take over America? All the things we would do is exactly, it made me appreciate what Ezekiel was going through. My goodness. How are you telling Israel the very thing they don't want to hear, can't hear, won't believe? If Babylon's coming, we'll go make an alliance with Egypt. No, don't make an alliance with Egypt. It'll go worse for you. And we're not trusting anything you say. Just that whole idea of delusion and truth and illusion from false prophets. And so I've asked that question to a few people. If you knew, if God was actually, because that's what in the dream, what Jesus said was, I've got to give them over to the dragon. And the person who had the dream had no idea what that meant. What is the dragon? What does that mean?
Yeah.
I shared it with one person. They said, would you want to know? I said, yes, so I can move to Canada. I said, well, dude, I'm telling you what, if the communists get here, Canada's not far behind. Bless their hearts. Yeah. And I don't live in the fear of any of that happening. I'm not a fear-based guy anymore. But I thought it's just a wonderful set of thoughts to wrestle with in your head playfully, but yet what if it's going to take that for the U.S. to turn back to God? What if it's going to take that? And what I liked about the dream was it wasn't just the secularists, which Christians like to blame for the problems in America and, you know, the fall of America or whatever, the secularists and the anti-God people. But there's really a part for the quote-unquote people who've pledged allegiance to Jesus, who are no longer following him anymore, who are caught up in all other kinds of allegiances and fears and lies and delusions, which we've talked about on the podcast before. The circumstances are somewhat similar to Israel's day.
Yeah.
And if the solution were that, would I want to know in advance? And I think I would say, yeah, I would. I'd want to know because I want my heart to be prepared.
Yeah.
I've shared this. I went through this thing a few months ago where I felt like I was in Gethsemane, having to prepare for something I didn't know was coming. I mean, I knew was coming, but I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
And what I thought it was didn't turn out to be any of that. What it was something far more painful. But I tell you what, I love that I could lean into that space for 4 or 5 months before it happened so that my heart was in a space of not panicking at the moment and leaning back into, as best I see Jesus leading me here and having the comfort of his heart in going through a situation for me in which there were no good choices.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of like Gethsemane. I compared to Gethsemane because that's Jesus, right? There are no good choices here. I'm either going to go to a cross and die, or I'm going to disobey my father and abort all that God's done to redeem the world already over generations of revelation. And there are no good choices other than following the master wherever he leads. Anyway, I thought I'd provoke you with that question.
No, it's good. What you just shared also is kind of where my heart would land too, because there's been times where God has done something similar where he starts to prep my heart or starts to clue me in as, hey, something's coming, or starts bringing me through some specific challenges or lessons that God's working on in my heart in order to be able to prep me for something like that, where, you know, my younger self would have tried to figure out what was coming, how I could best prepare myself for it, instead of saying, okay, Lord, what does it look like to lean into that? So you're saying that. So for example, when I was in Spain and got offered this crazy leadership opportunity with the ministry that I was working in, I felt like God nudged me and said, Kyle, you need to go through Los Angeles. The journey that I have for you, you need to go through this season in Los Angeles that I want for you. And so I was like, okay, like I'm not sure what that means. I don't know what that entails.
For Wyoming, boy, that's got to feel like going to Babylon, right?
A little bit, yeah. It definitely was like, okay, Lord, that's a little out there, you know, and I was letting go of going and living in the country that I had always wanted to live in. I always had wanted to live in Scotland, and this ministry leadership opportunity was heading this ministry in the region, in a region, you know, in Scotland. And I was like, man, Lord, why would you lead me away? Like the door is literally opening right there for what I feel like my heart really wants. And yet you're wanting me to go to Los Angeles, and I wasn't sure what he wanted me to go there for. And yet what I went there for was the death of my dream of being a religious influencer, religious leader influencer. That was my dream. That was what I was aspiring to. I wanted to be the next, you know, young name, whatever. And I mean, graciously went to Los Angeles, and that all just came crumbling down. Like, I would have never been able to plan for that. And yet,
wow,
looking back on it, it was so loving, but it was very painful. It was a very challenging situation.
Oh, imagine. Wow.
But then I also met you. I met my incredible wife. I met an amazing community out there, and God had something else up his sleeve.
He does. Even when our agenda is not what we, even as convinced as we are that God wants us to do a certain thing, God leads us to a place and it ends up serving something else.
So would you stay in country?
I would.
You would?
I would.
What if you felt like God was leaning you towards, this is me pushing my people out, like he used persecution during the Roman times, where he actually pushed people out of Jerusalem, pushed his people out into other countries to bring his kingdom and his love and life into those areas.
Now, mostly, as I read those stories, mostly they fled because of persecution. God used it, but God didn't like lead them out for that purpose.
No. It was definitely a forceful situation that I don't think was part of his plan.
Yeah, and how much of that is God doing it versus God making use of it once it's happened, kind of a thing?
That's true.
You know, because most diasporas are kind of the negative side of what the world is doing, and God's always gathering. You know, I'll bring you back to this land. I'll gather you to myself. And so I always see the gathering more of the God thing, and then the scattering more of the enemy kind of thing. But I know God makes good use of both, because there's nothing that goes on in our world that can't God can't do amazing things through, even through Babylonian attack, Assyrian attack. So much if we keep our hearts tuned to him. And that kind of brings me to the best thing I heard this week. Here's a quote I got from David Morsi in a book on being led by the Spirit. I found it on my desk the other day. I have no idea how I got this little book. David Morsi, I know nothing about him, but I looked him up a little bit. He's a guy that wrote years. He's dead. He's not even a living dude. Says this: if we keep cluttering our minds with the sounds of this world and listen more to them than to Christ, we are likely to make some unsound decisions.
Oh.
Which sounds so like good. A bit of an understatement when you put it in that context.
Slightly.
Yeah. We might make some unsound decisions, but oh.
You most certainly will probably make unsound decisions.
Yeah, I yearn for that space. I like staying informed of what's going on in the world, but if we keep cluttering our minds with the sounds, so it's not that you can't know and be aware, but keep cluttering, keep engaged with and, you know, live and die by politics and by current events and by even a potential communist invasion or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you're not listening to the Spirit. I love the space of being like, if I knew, and I've really wrestled with it, because I think the wane of 5 years ago, China, if I thought China was going to make an assault on America, man, I would pray, dear God, stop this. I'd be panicked and fear. I'd be in all that space where I wouldn't be listening to God. But I think now I love the space of being able to say, if that were to happen, and if my children, grandchildren don't have the same future I have, if it is under a communist oppression, I know people are going, oh, Wayne thinks the communists are coming. I don't know a thing about that, okay? I just had a friend who had a dream in the midst of reading Ezekiel, so I've been exploring some of these thoughts in my own weird little warped mind. But I love the fact that I really think at this point I'd be saying, God, whatever you have, man, I'm in. I'm in with you for what this is happening. Sarah and I just read Bonhoeffer's biography thing that Metaxas did about, you know, he got out of Germany when the Nazis took over. And then God drew him right back in there. You need to be here. And then some of the choices he made end up, he was executed before the Allies could liberate Germany. And one of the things he said was, I can't be here as a place of healing for God's people if I don't go through the trauma with them, if I'm not in it with them. So if God told me I need you to go to Europe during this time for some purpose, I would go to Europe or Canada or wherever. But I think the track record of those who have run from, I've got a good friend whose dad ran from America because he had a prophecy America was going to be destroyed by God. This like 40, 50 years ago, as a little boy, he was moved out of the country because of that fear. And I think responding out of fear is just a dumb thing to do. That's what I liked about this statement, man. If you're going to listen to the world more than listen to Christ, you're going to make some really bad choices. Mm. I think that's true. What about you? You got a best thing you heard this week?
I do. I was actually listening to a podcast series, and it was talking about, it was more of a theme versus a just a sentence or a phrase or a quote, but the theme was teaching cultural competence versus teaching cultural humility.
Oh, wow.
Teaching cultural competence versus teaching cultural humility. And it was a part of this counseling conference that I was, it was this U.S. mental health teleconference that I was a part of. And one of the breakout sessions, they were talking about that and how there's this whole movement to teach quote unquote cultural competence, which I think there's a good argument for learning about different cultures and how they respond. But what they were talking about with the cultural humility is learning how to take your own fears, your own agenda off the table, pausing and just being curious and saying, I don't understand. I don't know this. I don't know where this is coming from, but I want to learn. And I don't even know what landmines I'm stepping on because I'm just not aware. And so would you teach me? Would you guide me into what it's like to be you in your culture, in your society, in your growing up, your family of origin, et cetera? And I loved that. I really liked that approach or that perspective.
I do too. And it sounds like one of those things that's, you know, if you've grown up more as outside the dominant culture, so you feel like your culture's been despised or looked down on or whatever, then cultural humility sounds like a real negative, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're part of the dominant culture and you think you see right about everything and you live from a more advantaged position, I think cultural humility would be such a gift. That's one of those things where it's kind of like, it depends on how you come at this as to what you need. There are people that need the cultural confidence that my people are not damaged, flawed people, and we deserve a place in the culture. So that's, you know, people of color, especially in America, that may be more where they need to land. And then people like me and you, we need to land more in that space of cultural humility of just saying, mostly just engaged people like ourselves, and it would be wonderful to explore what other people have experienced and encountered. Just listening to Anna last week, and someone whose story is just so rife with a childhood I can't even conceive of. And I just sit here and go, God, I'm so grateful for the parents you gave me and the place I grew up in the world. And yet that's the outlier. You know, the rest of the world, there's lots of pain and need and extremity, even abuse in childhood. And oh my gosh, I'm touched always. If you haven't read her book, the Polygamous Daughter, it's a tough read, but a worthy read. It gives you just some of that cultural humility. Not everybody's story was like mine. So when I turn around and say, you just need to choose better, man, you don't know who you're saying that to and what they've already chosen to get where they are against the disadvantages that they've had growing up.
Well, and even the term, I've always had a really hard time with the idea of cultural competency, because to me that sounds very, very arrogant. Because to be culturally competent, so for example, if I'm going to be culturally competent in Moroccan culture, right? And in my mind, like, yes, I went and I spent some time living there. I tried to start learning some of the language. I met some people that I have some friendships with that are Moroccan. And yet the level of arrogance to say, oh, now I am competent in your culture. I mean, to have that kind of perspective, it's like, no, like even if I went and lived there for years, I still wouldn't consider myself competent in that culture, because they have a completely different experience than I do. They have a different lens than I do. And so to me, to say that I'm culturally competent just sounds incredibly arrogant to me, because I can't put myself there. I can't, like Anna was saying, to try to put myself in a mental space of what she endured and to navigate that into a more healthy and wholehearted space. I mean, the level of courage and inner heart strength that takes to be able to do something like that. And so even as a mental health professional, to say that I'm competent in trauma, like culturally competent in what it's like to grow up in trauma. Yeah, I had my own traumas that I went through, And yet to put myself in the in Anna's position and say, oh, yeah, I get it, what you're talking about. I totally understand the,
yeah, right.
You know, I'm a mental health professional that's competent in trauma. It's like, no, there's no way. There's no way I could understand that.
Yeah. Who can be competent about anything like that? I that's what I mean. You first said cultural competence. I'm just thinking about competent in my own culture. I wasn't thinking about trying to be competent in someone else's. Man.
Well, and that's the whole, that's a lot of the training. That's a lot of the, there was that whole idea of cultural competency was a big deal for a while as we're going to train you to be culturally competent. It's like, you can't, like, I'm sorry, but that's incredibly arrogant. But the idea of cultural humility,
yeah,
from my perspective, coming from where I grew up, is a very, it was a beautiful idea. And I love that imagery.
Yeah, because no matter what your bias is, no matter where you grew up, you're going to think what you grew up in is the only right thing and scope your conclusions based on that. So I love the humility that opens to a different story and a different life. And we're finding precious little of that. You know, what we didn't get into so much with Anna last week was just some of this conflict right now between so-called government experts about education and parents who feel like they're being left out of the process of what their children are a part of.
Yeah.
And I know it's easy to quote Harvard professors and the DOJ, whatever, and then take it to an extreme. Because I've seen video of school board meetings that are bordering on violence.
Yeah.
I do. But I've also been to and know school board meetings where parents are just really, really frustrated. You're just not listening to our concerns. You want to put stories of rape and sexual conquest in the reading program for 17 and 18 year olds. And some people really do. This book is worthy of it. So yeah, there's a rough scene in here, but kids need to wrestle with that scene. And parents, other parents saying, what are you doing, man? This is my child. I don't think they even, or maybe not 17, 18, but 12 and 13. I don't want my child confronted with those kinds of stories. And then the arrogance of the school district to say, oh, yes, you do. And yes, we know what's best for your child. So we're going to, and just that angst right now between a mistrusting public and a dominating school board, or even in California, it's not so much a school board locally as it is the state mandates that are put into school curriculums. Where parents are going, this is too much. This is not. And then so what? They pull their kids out. They homeschool, they private school, they whatever. And we're becoming more balkanized as a culture.
Yeah, this is honestly a hot topic for me. And I wish that we could have gotten into it a little bit more last week, but our conversation was so good that it was hard to even change it up a little bit. But,
right.
You know, for me, I like, for example, I remember as a fourth grader, my family and several other Christian families in the area got into a pretty intense dialogue with the school district that I was in, because as a fourth grader, they had us read a book. The teacher had us read a book about a male character who has sexual intimacy with a bear, fathers bear cubs, and the entire journey is him trying to protect and live and care for these bears in this journey.
I have never heard of this book. Wow.
Oh, it's and
wow.
And so it was like, wait, why are you having a fourth grader read a book that's chronicling the journey of a person who experienced bestiality and then supposedly fathered these animals from bestiality, and now he's trying to connect with nature and connect with the bears on a deeper level because he's now the biological father of these bears.
Oh my gosh.
And
was this one teacher's act? Was this part of a statewide curriculum?
It was one teacher's choice,
yeah,
on reading content. And so thankfully it wasn't state. Right. It wasn't a state dialogue or, you know, a state mandated curriculum book or anything like that. But just watching that process and watching them go to the school board and talking. And these were parents that got challenged because of their quote unquote conservative religious beliefs. And yet as a mental health professional, I would have a hard time justifying encouraging a fourth grader to read a book about bestiality.
Is the school district backing this a good idea? You should, kids should have read it. They didn't have any similar concerns.
No, they did. Actually, okay. Several of the board members weren't aware that that book was being brought into the curriculum, and they were quite concerned themselves.
That's what
and
I
so
would
thankfully
think.
there was some, I feel like, a fairly healthy resolution to that situation. And yet, man, I also coming from an educator's perspective, it's really challenging where less and less students are also being brought or sent to school ready to be educated. That's another big challenge, is that teachers are having a really hard time being able to even do their job because students are no longer being sent to school ready to be educated. So when they don't have basic needs that are being met, when they're not being fed, when they're not experiencing the basic love and safety that is supposed to be coming from a home, yeah. You know, a Maslow's hierarchy of needs talks about these level of needs that needs to be met in order for a student to even be ready to be educated. And yet the shift in today's culture is so few students are actually being sent to public school ready to be educated. And so as a parent, Jess and I have been really talking about with our daughter, what do we do with her? Do we send her to public school when that time comes? Or how do we navigate that? Because of a lot of the challenges that public school teachers are being faced with, low funding, high student to teacher ratios, major behavioral issues. I mean, all of these different things that are coming into the public school environment, where it has nothing to do with religion and everything to do with the fact that I want my daughter to be able to receive a quality education. And can that be done in a modern public educational environment? Sometimes yes, but man, I work with a lot of teachers that lament the challenges that they're facing right now as a modern educator.
I don't even know what to say about that. That's just where we're at. I'm more concerned about the mistrust between educators and parents.
Yeah.
And the cultural humility, if we'll go back to that, because I think the cultural arrogance of, I know what's best for your child.
Oh man.
Is a real disconnect from parents. And yet on the other hand, I can understand that some parents want to so protect their child that they can be 18 and not even know what the real world's about.
Yeah.
You know, they just kept them from everything, or they want to grow up in this little bubble that's just their Christian values only, and nothing that confronts the kid. And so this whole, I mean, that's where, to me, we joke about China coming at us, but the future of our republic really is, can we find a way back to some modicum of respect and humility towards each other, even where we disagree, which gets me back on the polarized nation and language of healing stuff that Anita and Bob and I scream about all over the place. Is there's got to be something that, and it, will there be anything except some kind of externalized pressure that forces us back to that? Because we're just, our culture's dealing with it in more balkanized ways.
Yes.
My group does this, your group does that. So we got to have separate schools, separate math, separate vaccine, whatever. It's just, it goes on and on to the sense that we don't have a cohesiveness that comes from mutual respect across our differences and find ways to communicate on these things. I worked with one school district with Ridge Builders, had a book that I had 40 parents at the school board screaming about this book. And I don't remember the content of it. I remember it being really, really edgy. And the school district was very conservative and just wasn't ready for it. And some teacher was trying to put it on. And I talked to the principal one day. I said, why are you defending this book? If you were, and they didn't have children in that age group yet. I said, if your child were 15, would you want them reading this book? And she looked at me and went, no, I probably wouldn't. And I said, then why are you defending it? She said, well, I just, you know, there's a lot of complaints in the district that the administration's not backing the teacher. So I felt like we ought to back the teacher in this case. Mm-hmm. And the school board did the same thing. And the teacher was wrong. And everybody could, I said, what are we going to do if 500 people come down and object to a math book? I said, well, if 500 parents come down to object to a math book, you have the wrong math book. I mean, come on. People
There's
are
lots
not
of other options out there.
Yeah, and I want to say that to educators. And I want to say to parents, most of these educators are parents.
Yeah.
And if you find a way to connect with them that's more not angry screaming at a board meeting, which is the worst way to impact a school district. It's the most personally feeling like you've really done something significant because you've gotten to an open mic and berated some public official. And it feels very empowering. but it's false because even, I don't know about other states, in California, they have public open comment times, but because nothing that's being brought up by parents is on the agenda, the school board can't comment. So you've set up the very thing where we're going to yell and rage at the school board, and the school board sit there and said, you know, we'll study this, we'll take a look at it. And you go, yeah, a bunch of, and so it just, it feeds the polarization paradigm. Instead of being able, if you have a concern, go first to your teacher, go to your principal, go, you know, work your way through the district until you find a person who can say, wow, I can understand your concern. And I think when people feel like everything's arrayed against them, they want to start at the top and yell and scream. And now we've got people actually advocating violence against school board people. And that's why the Department of Justice has gotten involved. And now everybody's, oh, Biden administration wants to censor parent. And no, it's none of, stay out of the extremes. None of those things actually help us communicate as a culture.
Well, it comes back to the language of healing, right? Where did, how many parents actually know the teacher? Have you taken the time, and vice versa with the teacher? Have you contacted that parent? Do you know what's going on in their life? Hey, because when you build that relational bridge, it's a lot easier to have a conversation about, hey, I don't understand why this is happening in the classroom, or vice versa. Like, is there something going on in the home that we can support you? We can probably try to get some resources for you, that type of thing. You know, because a lot of the teachers that I work with, when we're actually building a behavioral plan because this student is completely blowing up their classroom, they don't feel like they can teach. And my first comment and my first question is, so what's going on in the home?
That's good.
Have you asked? Have you paused? Like, do you know what's going on in this young person's life? And I get the teacher's perspective of, Kyle, I don't have time to ask. I've got 27 other kids that I'm trying to manage. I don't have time to be that personal or that individual in this situation. And that's where my role as a mental health consultant in the classroom comes in and says, okay, how do we bridge, how do we create that language of healing between the parent and the teacher and the complex trauma? Like what Anna was talking about last week, there's no easy straight answer.
Right.
It's complex. It's multi-tiered, it's multi-leveled. And so let's pause and have the humility to say, we're dealing with humans. We're dealing with a complex system. We're dealing with a broken system. So how do we create some harmony and some health and some positive movement in the midst of this situation?
And parents too. I mean, from the same standpoint, parents would be the same way, because mostly they get some frustration from the teacher because their kids got too much homework or read the wrong book or did something. And then they talk about it with other parents, and then they find out, well, other parents have the same concern. And then they've listened to some anti-public school rhetoric in their community of faith. So then they've ramped up to all this anger. And by the time they first talk to the teacher, they're already angry.
Oh, yeah. And they already have a solidified opinion.
Yeah. And that's a disconnect. The relationship with the teacher is not going to improve from there, because anytime you start with anger, they respond with defensiveness. Now everybody's hardening positions, and now you're going to escalate it to, you know, we're going to go above the teacher's head to somebody else, and then they're going to go back to their union, or they're going back to their people. And it's just, it's such a situation ripe for disaster. I love what you said. If you can just go down the first time and just talk to your teacher when you have a concern, just, hey, you know, I did that with Julie's teacher when she was in first grade. I remember a little problem, Julie came in, and it was the kind of thing where if what Julie was telling me was true, I was going to go down and, you know, raise some thunder at my daughter's school. And but I went down there somehow with the presence of thought to just sit down and with the teacher and say, I've got a little concern, and I wonder if you could help me with that. And I started to share what the concern was. Well, it turned out that I hadn't gotten the whole picture.
Uh-huh.
And instead of her saying, and I love this, because she didn't say, listen, you stupid fool, and blah, blah, blah. You know, you just don't get what's going on here. She looked at me. She looked at my daughter and go, Julie, is that what happened? And my daughter just started crying. And I went, okay, I realize I've been misinformed by something. And so I apologized to her. Went home, found out the real story. My daughter was afraid to tell me because, you know, dad might have gotten angry, and I probably might have when I heard the real story the first time. But now hearing it the second time with a daughter who's just devastated, it was very, very different. And yet I think if you start with anger, nothing improves.
it's like what we talked about before, where you're literally starting a conversation often with my silo group of people told me I can't trust you. And that's literally how you're starting the conversation. And so then where do you go from there? If that's how you start, if that's the underlying assumption that you're starting the conversation with, then there's no way that you can actually move into a better space.
Wrote a blog recently. Somebody recently told me, I don't believe you. They asked me a simple question. I give a simple answer. And the response was, I don't believe you. And I would lie to you why in this situation. I've got no, even this wasn't even like I've been caught doing something. It was just a request for information and a relaying of that information. And it was not the information they wanted. So I don't believe you. And yeah, once you decide you can't trust the person you're talking to, and isn't that what's going on a lot across culturally right now?
Absolutely.
I don't trust the teacher. I don't trust the parent. I don't trust this. I don't trust that. Now we've lost our ability to communicate.
Yeah.
That's so sad to me.
It really is.
And it comes back to, the blog was about the same thing with Jesus, and we can say, I believe you. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then Peter, Jesus said, well, I'm going to go to Jerusalem now. I'm going to get hacked up by the Pharisees and we get killed on the cross. And Peter's like, no, you won't. God forbid. We're not going to. And so this is so, I believe in you. I just don't believe you when you talk to me. And I've said often, particularly in the last few years, because I'm much more aware of this now than I ever have been, that the first time I hear something from Jesus, I'm usually already arguing with it in my head. I am exactly like Peter in Matthew 16. No, God, this, and I even find my joking going, this can't be you. Please, I don't want this to be you. And I'm talking to him about it. And but if Jesus is going to lead us to life, then he's got to bring us truth. And it's going to be most truth that we hear from Jesus is going to be uncomfortable. Why? I already know all the comfortable stuff I want to know. Right? I already believe the comfortable stuff. So when Jesus is going to point me in a new direction, it's going to challenge me. And then I've got to deal with whether I believe him or not. And if I know it's Jesus, I'm going to believe him. So we don't start there. We start with, this can't be Jesus, because I don't like it. So it's, I never say, Jesus asked me to, and I told him no. I just have never done that as far as I know. But I can say Jesus asked me to do something. And I completely convinced myself it wasn't him. And then I completely went my own way for a while. And then lo and behold, I discovered it was him. But the believing in him doesn't count if you actually don't believe him when he makes something known to you, especially when you don't like it.
Yeah.
And we were watching a movie the other day where they, and I love this, they were using the truth shall set you free. But they start with, it will be a struggle first. And I've gone to saying that, the John 8 scripture about, and you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free, but it will mess with you first.
Yeah.
Almost all truth that you need to know that you don't know will make you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And if you reject things because they're uncomfortable, you're not getting far.
No, you're going to stay in that siloed, isolated, and very wounded space.
Yeah, and if you don't trust people who tell you what they're thinking, to be honest with you, you're not going to have a relationship going forward. You're just not. You can't do it.
Or to encourage that, right? Like we talked a little bit about that idea of the relator a couple podcasts ago. And yet to invite that, to encourage somebody to provide that type of feedback to you, to create a space in your life where people feel like, even though Kyle may have a hard time with this, I know that he's going to have the humility to pause and take in that information instead of just throwing it back in my face and rejecting me. And so almost creating a safe space for somebody to bring that kind of truth that we don't want to hear, whether it be God or a friend or, our community, and man, just to be able to cultivate that in our life.
Yeah. Have the humility to say, even when somebody's telling you something you may not believe, it seemed like the first answer wouldn't be, I don't believe you. I think the first thing would be, that sounds a little outrageous to me.
Yeah.
That's kind of hard to believe. You could say that. You could, there's lots of ways to respond that keep a place saying, okay, we see this differently, but I don't have to attack you over it. I can just create space to hold it. Because what you want is people's sincerity. And you want to create a space, a safe place, a space slave, a safe place for them to speak into that, even where you disagree. I want to create that with God, most of all. I want to have a safe space for you to disagree with me and me not to reject it, me to be open to it, because I know you're bringing me words of life. I know there's no life in my delusions. There's life in what's true. Just because you believe, I love when people say, well, you know what I believe? What you believe doesn't matter if it isn't true. I believe it's going to rain today. Well, if it's not going to rain today, then you believing it's going to rain today is meaningless. And that's what we've lost sight of. The word belief and truth got somehow really separated, like opinion and fact. Your opinion is not fact. Your belief is not truth. It may be your truth for the moment, but if it's not truth with a capital T, then your belief in it is leading you into the darkness. And I love when God wants to, for us to be lovers of truth, for us to say, I want what's true, no matter how that challenges me, no matter what I have to reconsider, no matter what I have to, you know, change about how I'm responding, I want to know what's true, even when it messes, especially when it messes with me.
Yeah, and I think that's the, man, as we try to navigate that and press into that space, I just feel like that's part of that journey, right? Because that when, especially when I talk with people and they're talking about their anger and their frustration towards God, and it's like, look, he's not afraid of your anger and frustration. He's not afraid. If anybody models cultivating that space where we can be bluntly honest, and he may not enjoy hearing what I have to say, or agree with what I'm saying, but he's not afraid of it. He's willing to shoulder it. He's cultivated and he's willing to teach me that, Kyle, you can bring whatever you want to me. And I will love you through it. I will guide you through it. No matter how twisted it might be, no matter how broken the perspective might be, no matter how messed up your view of me might be, you can bring it to me and I will love you through it. I will honor it. And we can talk about it and navigate it together. And that, man, that was one of the most healing things he's ever offered me.
So even God, who is right about everything, has a cultural humility.
Yes.
Isn't that amazing? If anyone had the right of arrogance.
Yeah, to say that he was culturally competent.
Yeah, I'm right, you're wrong, you'll change. And some people see God that way, I don't. I see Jesus and his Father as very inviting us into the space of, I can work with your delusions to invite you to a place of truth if you can keep coming with me. Keep coming. Because the moment you cut me out, the moment you create a God in your own image, once you don't listen to God's truth anymore, what you in fact do is create a God in your own image who believes all the same things you do and who makes you happy in every way. When you've got that kind of God, you know it's your own creation.
Yeah.
Not him.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.